This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In his new book, Wealth and Democracy, political analyst Kevin Phillips says the last two decades of the 20th century echoed the excesses of the Gilded Age in the Roaring Twenties, when the government became captive to big money and private interests at the expense of the lower and middle classes. What's the result of such a period of concentration of wealth and power? Phillips says the answer is corruption in the private and public sectors, and even into academe, the world of ideas. And that, in turn, is crippling for democracy. Phillips' book offers readers a history of money, wealth, and power over the course of our history. The book's subtitle is A Political History of the American Rich. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments this afternoon. Here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Kevin Phillips is a regular contributor to National Public Radio's Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. In 1968, he served as an analyst for Richard Nixon's presidential campaign. He then became special assistant to the Attorney General in 1969. A year later, he left to write newspaper columns, publish his newsletter, The American Political Report, and to write books, including The Politics of Rich and Poor and The Cousins' Wars. Wealth and Democracy, A Political History of the American Rich is his 10th book. It is published by Broadway Books. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Kevin Phillips, good afternoon. Welcome. You note at the outset of a chapter titled Friends in High Places that power and wealth have rarely been far from one another. How has its influence differed over time? How is the situation different now than it's been in the past?
I think the principal difference is directness versus subtlety. The interaction of wealth and power 1,000 years ago was pretty blunt. It came at sword point with catapults, with the taking and sacking of cities and towns. And really, I guess, by the 15th, 16th century, the Renaissance and its early beginnings, it was getting a little more subtle. It still happened the old way, but you also had proximity to power and its importance in commerce and its importance in banking. And by the time we got into the 19th century, it was getting more sophisticated still. The 18th century did see a lot of fortunes in the United States come from privateering, from basically having a government commission to seize enemy merchant ships. But by the 19th century, democracy had come into play, and the rules of war were a little different, and more people began making their money in ways that had to be agreeable to the legal standards, whatever they might have been, and they weren't like they are now, although you could argue, what are they now?
Right.
But bit by bit, what we saw in the 19th century was a refinement of characterization of what was legal and what wasn't, corruption, honesty required of public servants or of businessmen, and all of that continued into the 20th century. But by the time you get to the later part of the 20th century, you're starting to see some deregulation now, as we can see in retrospect. There were pluses for deregulation and there were minuses. And some of the minuses were that it just became an awful lot easier to pull a lot of stuff, sometimes in cahoots with a politician, sometimes independently, but with the control of politics having passed to business and finance more and more during the 80s and 90s, their friends in high places basically were prominent among those responsible for the deregulation, for the bigger and better franchise for the private sector to do things that might have been questionable or even illegal before. And as a result, we've seen government and wealth still go hand in hand, but the hand clasp, I suppose you could say, was a little more private.
You say we're in a period of re-emergent plutocracy.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that the definition of plutocracy does fit what we saw let's say, up through this year, because this year people are fighting back. But whether anybody will use that name again, that term came into vogue during the Gilded Age, more than 100 years ago. And the use of the term plutocracy was widespread. And essentially what plutocracy means is government of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich. And we've certainly come back in many ways to that in the 1990s and the early part of this decade, and we'll see what happens. We've had two pieces of legislation that represent the politicians with the public's gun sort of cocked at their head moving to change it. And the first was the campaign finance reform, and the second now is the slap at corporations and separation of functions within the accounting industry. I'm not convinced this is going to change too much, but it certainly represents a shift in the direction of saying to the people who thought that, that wealth and power dictated control, back up.
Hmm. It's interesting that there seems in the past there was a lag time between when we first see a term such as the Gilded Age, when Mark Twain coins that term in 1873, but it isn't until more than a decade later that reformers and journalists jump on the reform bandwagon.
Well, I think that's exactly right. It happens slowly in the United States, and I think the reason it does is that Americans have the sense up to a pretty considerable point that wealth has been associated, if often with some bad things, equally often with good things, like putting railroads across the country and building the oil industry and all the things you can say about even the robber barons. But what tends to happen as wealth has more and more opportunity and feeds on itself and gets bigger and finds the stock market a wonderful magnifying glass, which happened in the Gilded Age, happened again in the 20s, and certainly happened in the 80s and 90s. Bit by bit, the public starts getting the sense that this isn't a bunch of people building railroads over the Continental Divide. It's a bunch of pieces of work doing numbers games. And it turns out, in the later stages of the boom, that's always what it is. The practices and the innovations and the techniques just outrun the old regulatory framework. And you see the rise of the trusts and the monopolies and the holding companies in the Gilded Age, all of the games in the 1920s with Ponzi schemes, and again, banks working both sides of the equation, both banking and investments, public utilities, holding companies that went bust, and just in the last 10 years again, another whole set of things that essentially proved themselves to be Ponzi scheme. So as people see this and they sense that, yeah, we did need 15 or 20 years ago to make things better for business, but my God, that wasn't the same as giving them the keys to just run and take over the country, then you start getting the change. And it's clearly started, finally.
Yeah. Would you give us some sense of the extent of the concentration of wealth we've seen in the past 20 years?
It's actually mind-blowing. Most people have some sense of it, but they don't really. They know it's gone to an extreme, but they have no idea how absolutely egregious an extreme. In 1982, Forbes magazine started its survey of the 400 richest Americans. And right at the top 30 richest individuals and families, number 30 had $500 million, and number one, the DuPont family, had $8.5 billion. That was it. That was the top 30, $500 million to $8.5 billion. You jump ahead 17 years to 1999, and you look at the top 30 families and individuals. What you get is number 30 had $7 billion, and number one, Bill Gates, had $85 billion. So what that means is the biggest fortunes increased tenfold. And this is while people in the middle barely stayed ahead of inflation. And sometimes didn't even do that because of some of the calculations of state and local tax burdens and health care and tuition and all the other things that weren't fully reflected in these calculations. So the people at the top were just making out, I use the term advisedly, like bandits. And when you drop down and you looked at the compensation that was going to the 10 most highly compensated executives in the country. In 1980, the average of these 10 had $3.45 million in the year. You go to 1988, the top 10 had an average of $22 million. In other words, it was up almost 700%. Then you go from 1988 up to 2001, and what had been $22 million in 1988 has jumped to $155 million in 2001. There was so much money flowing to the people near or at the top in the American business community that they became probably what most Americans would become in that situation, unfortunately, but they did become it. Just incredibly greedy, cutting every corner, jumping over laws that weren't completely closed, and most of them weren't, creating loopholes, just driving a truck through the ethics of the whole American corporate system. And we should have known it, because it's happened before. It happened in these previous wealth periods, and it'll happen again at some point in 2050 or 2060, but it's not going to happen again for a while.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, wealth was being concentrated among the most prosperous Americans. The social well-being of people was slipping, the lower and middle classes. There's a remarkable diagram in the book that charts social health and the domestic product from 1959 to 1996. And it's really quite something to see that.
Yes, it's stunning to me, because it shows that for the first time in American history, as far as we know, that the rise in GDP, gross domestic product, was not matched by a rise in the social well-being. Now, this is a set of indicators charted by Fordham University in New York, and it includes things like health coverage, literacy, death rates, percentage of people living in poverty, or children in poverty, I think is the one they use most often, drug addiction, number of people incarcerated, all of these yardsticks. And by these yardsticks, the country was losing ground during the same period that the millionaire data and the raw GDP numbers show this uptick, because such a large portion of the uptick was going to this small slice of Americans that it created something of an illusion as to what was happening in the rest, and especially the bottom two-thirds. One number which is equally appalling, the calculation was that the top 1% of Americans, that's basically for the year 2000, starting at about $450,000 a year, $500,000 a year, they had as much disposable income as the poorest 100 million Americans. And the upshot was that the whole consumer system started gearing itself to the upscale. And you can see this in all these incredible glossy magazines and the expensive cars and the luxury goods, just everything that would suggest the spending patterns of people with a lot of money went absolutely ballistic. So all of this creates problems, and that's another thing that requires another answer. But you create corruption with these concentrations of money, and you don't just create it in politics and in finance. You create it in the philosophy and culture of the country as essentially the people with money try to influence the culture and the philosophy, basically to follow their cues and applaud what they do.
Mm. And this has affected the so-called ivory tower.
Yes. Well, the ivory tower isn't an ivory tower. It's a green tower. It requires a good bit of funding. Some of the money that goes into academe comes from government. Some comes from foundations. Some comes from tuition. An awful lot comes from research and from corporations. And it's a rare college that isn't interested in setting up some endowed chairs and libraries and so forth, and perhaps an institute for the study of the American marketplace, and that institute will just turn into a pumping factory for what amounts to laudation of the processes and practices of the period. And this, again, was something that was very visible 100 years ago when essentially in order to justify the rise of the rich, you had what was called social Darwinism, the idea that survival of the fittest applied in economics too, and you shouldn't try to help the people who weren't making it because really they were losers in the evolutionary process. You had the deification of the marketplace, and of course we saw that again in the 80s and 90s. And this becomes, in the larger scheme of American history, a corruption. I suppose you could say that socialism is a corruption, and sometimes the welfare state levels go so high that conservatives have some point in saying that too is a corruption. But the extremes of marketplace and worship of success and entrepreneurialism and just saying nothing else matters, that is a corruption in the stream of American history, and it's something that we've seen very vividly in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So this isn't new, but is this period that we're going through now, was it foreseeable?
I think it was foreseeable, and I think it was foreseen. People wrote about some of these dynamics. What wasn't foreseeable, and you didn't really see it discussed, so I suppose it's fair to say it really was not foreseen, was the rise in the later part of the 90s of another one of history's technology bubbles, in terms of a mania then becomes, with the help of the financial markets, this huge bubble that creates almost a stampede to get your money into stocks. And we've seen technology bubbles in the United States before in the stock market. In the 19th century, they came with railroads, and the bubbles would be implosions of railroads. The bonds would just lose value, and they'd go into receivership, and that was all over the place in the 1870s and 1890s. In the 1920s, the technology bubble that burst, that helped give us 1929, was in aviation, automobiles, radio, motion pictures, aeronautics, just lots of electric gadgets. That was a very big thing that decade, and it popped. So when we saw the technology bubble starting to build in 1997 and 1998, it was entirely reasonable for people who knew something about history to say, hey, you know, this is another technology bubble. And I remember NPR had a comparison on one time in 2000 about the enormous parallels between the tech bubble and the railway bubble that the British had the worst of in the 1840s. But history never stops it from happening again. It may provide a little bit of a critique as it occurs, but it never stops it.
Hmm. There were candidates in the last presidential election who talked about some of these things. They talked about campaign finance reform and corporate welfare. Why didn't that message catch fire?
Well, in some ways it did. Let me take the individuals involved. I don't think Bill Bradley caught on in the Democratic primaries. I think he just doesn't have a charismatic personality. And his message was a little professorial, but he, of course, did talk about the corrupting role of money. In the Republican camp, you had the obvious candidate of sort of hereditary position and family and money and corporations was George W. Bush. And his opponent, John McCain, made what for a Republican was quite a race against the power of money and the extent to which it had corrupted the system and the corruption of the tax programs and the Republican tax bills and how he'd bring in CEOs to the White House and ball them out and so forth. And I think if McCain had really not just come on like a house of fire, but had had time to build a high-powered campaign and had the money to do it, he would have given George W. One hell of a race. But in South Carolina, the current president mobilized Bob Jones University and the religious right, and that was where McCain started to go down. So I think McCain represented a voice for all of this before we knew what was going to happen in a major way to the stock market and the economy and the tech bubble and the extent of business corruption that's now unfolding. Ralph Nader talked about it, but Ralph Nader had run a very poor campaign in 1996, and he had to live down that credibility problem. And I think it would have gotten his 5% if it hadn't been for the nip-and-tuck race between Gore and Bush.
Mm. What's the outlook for candidates like McCain, Nader, and Bradley in 2004? You think we'll see some reformers in the next presidential election?
I think we'll see some, but I'm not certain as to whose name I'd want to put my chips on. John McCain, I think, will be 66 or 67 in 2004. He has a skin cancer problem. I don't know what he's going to do. I bet he doesn't entirely know what he's going to do himself. His contempt for George W. has been rising again in the last 3 to 4 weeks, so clearly the heat is in his bloodstream again a bit, but I just don't know what he'll do. Otherwise, on the Republican side, I just don't see anything. There may be disgruntlement with Bush, but Herbert Hoover got renominated in 1932. The Republican Party can take a turkey and put him in front of a mirror and have him look like the second coming of Machiavelli in their own mind. So I'd be very surprised if George W. was defeated for renomination. Now, could he retire if things are falling apart by then? I suppose so. On the Democratic side, well, there's several Democrats running who talk a pretty good game, and maybe in the end they would move in that direction. House Democratic leader Dick Gephardt, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle from South Dakota. How could I forget that? And he's, again, somebody who I think you have to take seriously on those issues. But I can't take Al Gore seriously. Al Gore had his chance last time, and if you can't beat George W. Bush in a debate, you ought to go and get a professorship somewhere and stay out of politics.
Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Kevin Phillips is our guest this afternoon on the program. His latest book, Wealth and Democracy, A Political History of the American Rich. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting for us on the toll-free line. Let's go and talk with this individual now. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi there.
Your comments about Ralph Nader, I recently heard that he was taking to task in a suit the debate commission that will or will not allow certain persons to be on the debating program. I don't know if you'd heard about that, because that was a very definite issue regarding his opportunity to address the situations like the other candidates, and apparently was not just thumbs down, but blocked at the gate and even removed with police and state troopers were keeping him from even attending, even though he had a pass and a ticket to go to the debate.
Well, I think something should be done about that.
Well, he's pursuing that.
I think it's for all practical purposes, a fraud on the American public.
Yeah.
It's something the two parties have set up not to enforce opportunity, but to enforce lack of it.
As well as a limited exposure to
exactly.
Candidates through the media, as controlled as they are.
Well, the people who have been put in charge of it, I'm not certain who they are right at the moment, but they've been Republican and Democratic loyalists who've been party chairmen, and the Republican won back in, I guess it was 1996.
Well, using
anyway,
a phrase...
He's somebody who was the Washington representative for the gambling industry. I mean, what does that tell you about the type of person they
yeah.
put in to be the party representative on something like this?
Yeah, well, using the phrase conversation, such as you're having, is raising a lot of hopes and inspiration, and I'm so glad to hear you and continue the good work. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. After President Bush spoke on Wall Street last week, someone, I think it was Barbara Boxer, but I might not be remembering this correctly, said she had been looking for a Teddy Roosevelt, but what she saw was a teddy bear. What do you think about the president's remarks last week on Wall Street? And then maybe after answering that, you would talk with us about Teddy Roosevelt and how he was able to tackle the corrupt forces of his day.
Well, I think that Barbara Boxer's analogy to saying a Bush was a teddy bear is unfair. When I was 3 or 4 or 5, I'm pretty sure I had a teddy bear. I can even remember seeing pictures of it. It's perfectly harmless, and it's an insult to a teddy bear to say that's what George W. Bush is. George Bush is a lightweight. If his name had been Smith, he'd be an assistant bank vice president in Midland, Texas. And I can't even take it seriously. I think it's appalling that he's there and that he's just not going to be somebody who can deal with all these issues. He certainly can't deal with a corruption issue. He has no really high-level business experience that's worth much. People say, oh, he's an MBA from Harvard. Well, we ought to have some sense. That's not what it's cracked up to be either. But he was involved in 5 different small potatoes gas energy-type companies in Texas, and none of them really did anything except pick up some contracts and small-bore politics in getting some funding for some of the ventures. He's not a very sophisticated person in a lot of ways. And his ability to stand up and talk about the factors involved in the market, you think you're talking with somebody in a high school class that's visiting the stock exchange. I wouldn't say anything terribly good about a lot of the Democrats, but I said for a long time and continue to feel and didn't stop feeling even right after 9/11 that George W. Bush is not a particularly sophisticated person and not a good person to have in dealing with this sort of problem, although he made a perfectly decent sheriff after 9/11.
And Teddy Roosevelt, how was he able to tackle the corrupt forces of his day?
Well, he didn't tackle them as much as he would like to have. The feistiest comments from Teddy Roosevelt came after he left the presidency. In the beginning of 1909, he hadn't run in 1908. He had 3 years of McKinley's term and then 4 years of his own term, and then he stood down. And he was so disgusted about the way the Republican Party went back to its sort of complicitous behavior with business, although you'd say the same thing of the Democrats again in many ways, that he decided he'd try to run for the Republican presidential nomination, and he couldn't get it, because he was really attacking everything that the Republican administration stood for or the party finance types. And then he ran as a bull moose or a third-party candidate. That's when he made all of his feisty statements. But he wasn't in a position to implement them at that point.
Mm. You know, thinking of third parties, what's the outlook for a viable third party to emerge in our near future?
Well, it's hard for me to see how Nader's Green candidacy in 1996 was so ineffective that the sense of him not being able to get the 5% was pretty strong among a lot of political professionals, and in the end he didn't, so the Greens don't get money automatically in the next presidential race. I don't know whether Nader plans to run again. If he were to run in the Democratic primaries, I think he'd scare the bejesus out of them, because in any state with a bunch of universities, he'd get himself 20 or 25%, and he might even win a few states. But I just don't see a third party, unless and until the stock market and the economy take another downward turn, in which case there's going to be so much frustration on people's part that maybe there will be enough of a demand again that we get a second shot at getting a Perot-type figure, and hopefully this time one that has all the wires going to the right terminal.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Again on the toll-free line, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. Mr. Phillips, in the late 80s and early 90s, when I first became aware of a kind of intellectual force pushing America toward free marketism, and that philosophy and that ethic, I detected a foreign influence. This would be like the first time I can even have any idea that there were foreign people pushing America in an intellectual direction, and that was from Great Britain. And these were Margaret Thatcher's acolytes who came over here and wound up at the American Enterprise Institute and the Hoover Institute. And lo and behold, on Sunday afternoon talk shows on TV, or Charlie Rose, perhaps, I'm not sure that was one of them, but shows like that, I'd hear these young guys with British accents waxing eloquent and forceful about how America had to become more free market oriented, how individual Americans had to take on more risk, how we were too cozy and complacent and coddled with the leftovers of the New Deal. We had to throw all that off. And did you detect that when you went back and researched the rise of this attitude that sort of penetrated America's popular culture to at least some degree in the last 15 years?
Well, I was still a Republican, I won't say activist really, but supporter, and had voted for Ronald Reagan twice. I can tell you sort of the chronology. Margaret Thatcher came in as prime minister over there in the late 70s, and she was more on the cutting edge of deregulation and supply-side tax policies than Reagan was. But obviously the United States was the big gorilla in the whole ball game, and a number of the intellectuals that had ties to her by the early 80s, as they could see some of the same thing happening in the United States, did in fact migrate over here and hooked up with the conservative intellectual movement. And I think a number of them were actually pretty smart, but they helped. They didn't do it themselves. They just helped the direction that was already taking shape through similar forces in the United States, similar to those that you'd seen in Britain, that were producing this conservative thrust on an economic dimension. And I think it went way too far.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to a listener who's waiting for us on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead.
Calling to ask, I'm surprised that the reaction to the 20-year sentence for Mr. Lind has been so muted. There have been a few editorials saying it's light, but after all the tough talk, it just seems unusual that there's no reaction. Secondly, the fact that the president was involved, or the White House was involved in the negotiations at this early stage, that really surprised me. I don't know what the history on that is. Thank you.
I'm not quite sure what the caller is referring to in the second part of his question there.
Well, I understand the White House was involved in the negotiated plea, according to the announcement of the prosecutor, at this stage in the process. I thought it was meant to be a judicial decision at this point, not a political one.
Well, I don't know the facts here, so I'm just going to give you a generalized reaction. I'm not sure that Lind would have been somebody that would have been the sort of person you want to focus a whole lot of attention on as somebody who was this enormously culpable figure that you have to devilize. I mean, he just seemed like sort of a schlep. And maybe the administration didn't want to have him become a symbol of this issue. That wouldn't surprise me. I wouldn't see anything particularly malevolent in that. Just take him out of circulation and write him off as a jerk with appalling judgment.
And we'll leave it at that and go on. And I will invite other callers to join us with questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. The nervousness that we feel about the events of last September and the tumbling of the stock market and the revelations of corruption in corporate America. Are these things all coming together, and how do you think they will play out here in the midterm in our political life? Let's just take, for example, the coming midterm elections.
Well, I think the whole question of 9/11, people have to remember, what was it that the terrorists attacked? Was this some gratuitous attack on a restaurant in the upper floor of the World Trade Center? Obviously not. It was an attack on the heart of the American financial district. And to the extent that the terrorists conceived of the United States having gone far enough in the direction of making itself into a financial country to be vulnerable that way. I think we're seeing some evidence of that. I think the evidence of that was already out there on the table in 2000 from the NASDAQ crash and from the enormous loss of wealth and the extent to which the country was moving into a recession in the summer of 2001. And the upshot of this is that the financial economy now is showing this weakness again, and if the terrorists come back in with a follow-up, I think you're going to have public opinion react in a very concerned and worried way because of the sense that there's weakness in the economy far above and beyond terrorism, and that we had this enormous bubble, and now we're paying the price. It's the hangover after the party.
That's one of the themes of your book, financialization and the excesses of financialization. Maybe you would take a moment here just to talk with us about how the economy has been transformed by financialization and how we are vulnerable to the excesses of it.
Well, I think that's a major problem. What's happened to the United States in the last 20 years? Let me take the denouement first. You've had the fire sector, finance, insurance, and real estate has moved ahead of manufacturing in the gross domestic product, and just a couple of years ago moved ahead of it in profits, too. Finance has been favored enormously by the deregulation of finance in the 80s and 90s, the ability to offer a whole lot more services, by the gross favoritism of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury that have bailed out all kinds of financial institutions, rescuing them from the most stupid decisions, but they do it because that's the financial system. Then you've had the rise of computer power and the extent to which finance can do all kinds of things that it never used to be able to do and throw an incredibly wide net through computer networks, through derivatives and program trading and a wired financial system that exists for every type of decision-making process and even gambling process. And this has snuck up on us. We should have had a national debate. Do we want this to become a country where finance dominates the economy? Because when that happens, finance tends to work for a small number of people, a much smaller number than manufacturing worked for. And that's a very difficult set of circumstances, and now we see that the price of finance dominating, whatever it may or may not be in terms of terrorist vulnerability, is certainly very high in terms of the extent to which the financial system going crooked and soft and untrustworthy in the way that it has in the last 8, 10, 12 weeks threatens people's nest eggs, the money they've set aside for kids for school, retirement funds, all kinds of things. So if you've let finance get this big and powerful, then when they turn out to have gone off the tracks, the price is enormous.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener on line one. Good afternoon. Is there a caller there? No, let's go on to line two.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say thanks for writing this book. I hope people read it, turn off the TV, whatever, read something. I was watching, well, speaking of TV, I was watching C-SPAN, and they were debating the tax bill or some issue related to it, and a congressman got up and he just put this statistic out here. He said, "If about the current the recent tax cut, people with $1 million income would get a tax cut of $53,000, and that was 60% of the people in the United States make less than that. Does that sound right?"
No, it's an awful lot more than 60% of the people make less than $1 million.
No, 60. Let me
restate what I think you're saying.
60,000.
Is that a very large percentage of the tax reduction would go to the richest 10%, and even 30 or 40% goes to the richest 1%. I believe that's correct as a description of the president's tax program. And it's just amazing to me that this hasn't been debated more fully by the public, and the public doesn't seem to understand that. And, of course, the people in the top 5 or 10% understand where the benefits are going, and that's why they're so anxious.
Hmm. We're here at the end of the time that we can spend together today. Before we go, I would like to ask you this question as a kind of a follow-up to what you just said, and that is, how are the media doing in terms of covering these stories, and what would you like to see in the way of political coverage in our newspapers and television and radio?
Well, I think the media are slow to deal with a lot of these issues because most of the major media in the United States, not all, but most, are corporate-owned. And it's not that the news divisions sit down and say, we can't cover this because it's corporate, but there is this sense that senior editors have that it's probably not a good idea to go too far. So as a result, you don't have the media on the cutting edge of these issues at all. And it takes the sensational developments of the last 6 or 8 weeks, and then you really get the news organizations coming in. But they're not going to be self-starters on this sort of issue.
So you think it's up to the grassroots, or you think it's up to the public to step forward and cry out for reform?
It's going to take the public stepping forward with great degrees of concern and revulsion to make this stick, yes.
Yeah.
That's in terms of how they respond to polls, how angry they get, letters they write to people in Congress, and whether they vote and how they vote in November. If the public doesn't get involved and show its anger and justify the politicians' fear that that anger is out there, then we may see some of the gains that appear to be in motion just fade.
Evaporate now. Mr. Phillips, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Kevin Phillips has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Wealth and Democracy, A Political History of the American Rich. It is published by Broadway Books.